We are talking once again with Jov Parrish, co-editor of Eat the State and columnist with the Seattle Weekly. How are you today, Jov?
I'm great. Kind of. Just a little bit, I'm kind of hanging in there.
Well, we'll try and get through this as quickly as possible.
It'll make it as painless as possible.
Well,
that's right.
We'll only do like 28 minutes today.
Gee, thanks. You're not going to dock my pay for this, are you?
No. You're still paid for the full 30 minutes. So
yeah,
no.
Just the same that I ever get, right?
Exactly. There's the same piece of coal in your stocking. So you are about to leave for a very important event coming up here soon.
Yeah, I'm about to leave for Seattle Part 2, as folks are pulling it. There was a great headline in Slingshot, which is an anarchist publication out of Berkeley, that said, Miss Seattle? Go to D.C. And for those of us who didn't miss Seattle in terms of the protests against globalization, a lot of us are going to D.C. also. There's probably 150, 200 people from Seattle who are going to Washington, D.C. next week for the protests against the IMF and World Bank at their spring meetings in D.C. Maybe one of the largest direct actions in recent modern history in the U.S. It's really very exciting because D.C. has had a number of large protests over the past, 20 years, a couple times every year, some group or another, for some reason or another, gets thrown to D.C. and rounds up tens of thousands of people. And it gets a couple inches in the New York Post and gets, rather than the New York Times, and gets ignored in the Washington Post. But most of those have been permitted marches. This is an unpermitted direct action to try and actually shut down the meetings in the spirit of Seattle. And that hasn't been seen in D.C. in a long time. It's going to be very interesting to see how the Washington police react to this. They're pretty panicked so far. They've already got barricades up around Lafayette Park and the White House. And they're being quoted as saying they're not going to be caught napping by this. No, sir, they're going to be ready. So I don't think we can count on somebody like Mayor Schell saying, well, we just want to have our tradition of peaceful protest and everybody having their word, and the policy that enabled protesters on November 30th to catch police napping, basically. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's going to happen on April 16th, but it'll be very interesting to see how it plays out.
So the police department there has dealt with these type of situations quite a bit more than the Seattle Police Department had dealt with.
Well, they've certainly dealt with crowd control quite a bit more. I don't know if they've dealt with people chaining themselves to tripods in the middle of the street. That kind of stuff, I think, is pretty new for them. Mm-hmm. Those kind of protests are basically West Coast style protests. I mean, they come from forest actions in the Pacific Northwest and affinity groups in the Bay Area and some of the anti-nuclear stuff that's happened traditionally in places like Diablo Canyon and Trojan nuclear mm-hmm. power plant, and also some of the stuff back east. But this is relatively new in terms of the type of protest that was so successful on November 30th, being exported back east.
Now, what kind of events are you expecting there? Are you expecting the same size of crowd as Seattle?
They're really trying to replay it as much as they can. There's a Jubilee 2000 action that's happening this weekend that's sort of kicking the whole thing off, the same way that the Human Chain at the Kingdom, the exhibition hall, served that purpose in Seattle. There will be all kinds of workshops. There's a convergence space that's happening all this coming week and into next week. The IFG is having an all day long forum this coming Friday, at one of the churches in Washington, D.C. A lot of the things are being done very similarly to what was done for the World Trade Organization in Seattle. Mm-hmm. How Washington responds to them is a different question. There's a couple of factors that are very different from what happened with the World Trade Organization. One is that for the WTO, there was months and months and months of local organizing and education by people on what are really fairly esoteric trade issues, saying this is what's going on, this is why it's important to you. And the second reason it's different is that it is important to you. The World Bank and the IMF are are important primarily in the third world. They're incredibly destructive there. They're basically neocolonialist forces that that go in, impose structural adjustment programs that gut social spending in third world governments, that you know, lower tariffs and increase by devaluing currency, increase inflation, and basically wipe out the middle class. You know, increase the wealth of the elite and make everybody else very poor. While they extract the resources from the country. And this sort of model has been the idea of, quote-unquote, how we develop the third world for the last 30 years. For the last 50 years, the IMF and World Bank have been operating essentially without protest in the first world. There have been incredible riots and all kinds of different protests in the third world, but the IMF has been able to weather those. This is the first time, really, that they're going to run into this kind of opposition in the first world. It'll be very interesting to see who shows up when, number one, you have most of the people not coming from the D.C. area, not coming from the local area, as happened in Seattle, where you had at least half of the demonstrators were local and most of the arrestees were local. In Washington, D.C., it's been mostly people coming from other parts of the East Coast and the Midwest. It's going to be very interesting to see who shows up when it's not the interests of you and me that are at stake here, but the interests of people in the third world. With the WTO, we could point to laws in the United States that were being abrogated and say, this is how it affects you and me. You don't have that with the World Bank and IMF.
So there's a pretty big question mark there then.
The organizing has been tremendous. I think the turnout's going to be very large, but I'm just saying that that's a different factor than what we had in Seattle. But I think it's going to be a comparable size crowd.
Now, how do you anticipate, obviously, going back to the WTO, the news media just totally focused on the actions of a few people when they were breaking windows and such, and use that extensively on any time they were talking about the situation in Seattle. Do you anticipate that the media is going to be looking for a nice little spin like that?
Oh, they already have been. There's been a tremendous amount of media building up to these demonstrations back east, especially in the Washington Post and the Washington Times, and it's been very much focused on the anarchists that are coming to town and the potential for violence and the potential for violent demonstrations. There's a permitted rally that's happening at the Ellipse that's being endorsed by the AFL-CIO. But they're staying away from the direct action because, you know, it might turn violent. There have been a number of anarchist groups that have explicitly disavowed the nonviolence guidelines that have been adopted by the Mobilization for Global Justice, which is, you know, like Dan in Seattle is the umbrella group that's organizing these protests. Mm-hmm. And there are not as many windows to break in Washington, D.C. as there are in downtown Seattle. There aren't as many upscale businesses, but there are a lot of federal buildings with a lot of offices, and that might be an inviting target to an anarchist that thinks government should be dismantled. There's a lot of government to dismantle in Washington, D.C. So I think you are going to see some of that. And, you know, strategically, I think it's going to make more sense to have the property destruction in Washington, D.C. than it did in Seattle, because the nonviolent protest is not as likely to be successful on its own. In Seattle, you had a complete shutdown of the World Trade Organization. You didn't need the additional element, the additional shock element of targeting corporate businesses the way the window breakers did. In Washington, D.C., you're probably not going to shut down the meetings of the World Trade, the World Bank, and the IMF. Mm-hmm. So all bets are off.
All right. And then the World Bank and the IMF have, I believe, they have their headquarters there in D.C.?
Yes.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's why
it's going to be at
their
headquarters.
They're going to be all the action centering around that. So.
And these are spring meetings that happen every year. So this is just the first year that this has happened. And it's strictly out of the momentum that came from the Seattle demonstrations. This was the logical next target in the United States for people to focus on.
All right. And so if people want to be watching the events, in addition to getting the fine news coverage that comes from the national news affiliates and such, I believe.
Yeah, and by the way, I'll be doing this program from D.C. next week, so I'll have some reports on what's going on there, although the action themselves won't have happened yet.
All right. And the actions themselves are actually planned, could you remind me again?
For April 16th, which is Sunday, and April 17th, which is a week from Monday.
All right. So you, and will you be back in town then after that? So we'll be able to get the straight from the horse's mouth.
and as I said, there are a number of people from Seattle who are going out to this protest. Right. It's really quite inspiring to see that many people making the trip back east.
Right. Some, I believe, have already left on buses.
Buses and cars and caravans of all sorts are heading east from the Bay Area and from the Pacific Northwest.
And I believe the local independent media center is going to be on their website. Will be covering some of this as well.
Yeah, and there is an independent media center that's being started in D.C. also that's being helped out by a lot of the same people who did the IMC in Seattle. The technical knowledge that was gained by the IMC here is being used to start an IMC there. And is also being used to start IMCs in Philadelphia and Los Angeles for the major party conventions that are coming up this summer. We're seeing that model spread to different parts of the country, and hopefully in each of those different parts of the country, the IMCs will survive in each of the cities past the actual protests and become a permanent institution.
Yeah, like the local one is, and people can get can connect on that via the web to www.indymedia.org.
And one other thing to note, if you're not glued to C-SPAN and watching the events themselves on April 16th, you might want to join people here locally who are going to be doing a solidarity action. That's at noon at Westlake, and they're going to be touring various corporate and financial institutions downtown and letting them know that they oppose globalization as well.
Okay, so that's going to be happening on the 16th?
On the 16th, on a Sunday.
16th at noon. All right, write that down here. So that we can announce that again.
Yeah.
All right. Well, anything else on that? We certainly have some related things connected to that.
Oh, yeah.
Turns out you got a firsthand look at a recent report that came out with in terms of the Seattle Police Department's role in the WTO.
Yeah, the Seattle Police Department released its after-action report, quote-unquote, regarding the WTO demonstrations this week, and it was really very notable for what it didn't say as well as what it did say. It did not make any acknowledgement of possible civil right violations of protesters or civilians or bystanders, even though you had literally hundreds of people on December 1st who were arrested, innocent people who were arrested with the same police report. I mean, you know, so they were clearly screw-ups by the police. There were screw-ups by the police in terms of the number of injuries that were reported in local hospitals by unsafe use of chemical weapons, for example. But there was no acknowledgement of that whatsoever. In fact, there's a passage declaiming how wonderful the performance was not only of the Seattle Police Department but of all the other law enforcement agencies that came in and helped out during the WTO week that have so far been scapegoated by SPD as saying these were the people that were out of control, it wasn't our officers. Well, those officers were praised in this report as well. So that was one thing that was missing. Another thing that was missing was any acknowledgement that they didn't listen. The SPD is angling, and this was in the Times yesterday as well, angling in the report for repeal of the ordinance that prohibits surveillance of political groups in Seattle. They were angling for the repeal of that because allegedly they couldn't gather enough intelligence information on protest groups before the WTO events. Well, the protest groups, the main body of the direct action groups, told the police, told the media, told city officials exactly what they were going to do and exactly how they were going to do it weeks before. They told them they were going to shut the WTO down. They told them they were going to do it by gridlocking downtown. The problem with the police department is they didn't believe them. Mm-hmm. They did. They had the information. They just didn't treat it as credible. The idea of repealing this ordinance is a little bit of a red herring for taking responsibility for just not listening and not taking the adversary seriously in this case.
And wasn't that in part there? A contradiction in the report itself, where they were saying that they were told from other agencies like the FBI that this was going to be of a certain magnitude and such, and that they had relied on how well the APEC conference had gone, and they used that as the model.
Yes, and not only was that a contradiction, but there was also various points within the report where they were praising the protesters for being well organized, for having good communications and good tactics, using flanking maneuvers and being very sophisticated in how they approached the police. Well, if they were so sophisticated, then maybe you should have taken them seriously in the first place when they told you they were going to shut the meetings down.
Yeah, although it seemed like somewhat of a stretch as how much they were painting it as to how sophisticated all the protesters were. It was almost like as if all 50,000 of them were well trained in the art.
Well, they were well trained. They were taking orders from somebody. The police were regretting. There was one point in the report where they were regretting not having arrested all of the leaders early on Tuesday morning. Well, they still haven't gotten the idea that there were no leaders to this protest, that the protest would have gone on just the same, you know, if they had arrested 100 people on Tuesday morning, all the people they could find with cell phones, it still would have gone on just the same because of the affinity group structure.
Exactly. In fact, that's what very much impressed me after they did do the arrests of 500 people, that later on Thursday and Friday, there was still, I mean, incredible unity and coordination and such. So this recent article in the paper, I believe, had it implying that Mayor Paul Schell was backing that this ordinance should be revoked as well.
Yeah, which is something of a surprise, but I mean, Schell's going to take a lot of heat for the different reports and investigations that are coming out. He didn't from the SPD report because it was an internal report, but when the independent auditor in the mayor's office comes out, and when the city council comes out, I think the tactical leadership of the city, which is the mayor's office, is going to come in for a lot of criticism. So I think he's trying to hedge his bets. I talked to Jim Compton, who's the city council member who's heading the city council investigations, yesterday, and he was saying that there's just no way in Hades that there's 5 votes on council for repealing those ordinances. The people are very aware that those ordinances have been there for 30 years, that they were there for a good reason because there were serious abuses in the police department before they were put in place. So I wouldn't get too worried about those press reports, but it is another good reason to consider Paul Schell as being seriously out of touch and unfit for office.
So do you think then that he, in fact, was just trying to appease the police, kind of saying, gosh, I'm sorry,
oh, absolutely,
I didn't give you more support earlier, and
absolutely,
so now I'm trying to make up for it?
And one of the big ways that the police are going to be appeased, you see, there unfortunately are two different ways of looking at what happened during the WTO week in Seattle. You can either say that, gee, it's a shame things were all screwed up because we lost control of the streets, or it's a shame things were all screwed up because we lost control of the cops. Unfortunately, the way the media, the Times and the PI and the TV stations and city officials are almost universally looking at this, with the exception of Steinbrück and Licata and a couple of other city officials, is the law enforcement angle. And that's really what the after action report by the SPD reinforces, is the law enforcement model of, gee, this was a disaster because we didn't have control of the streets, we didn't use enough chemical weapons, but gee, weren't they fun and effective that we did use them as many as we did. An appalling lack of awareness of what they actually did to human beings. Appalling lack of awareness of why Amnesty International, for example, would have been so alarmed, why so many people were so horrified across the country when they saw these images of RoboCops, you know, the Star Wars imagery of people being attacked and sprayed with rubber bullets and pepper spray at point-blank range. Just appalling actions on behalf of the police are basically going unchallenged by the city at this point. It's very disturbing.
I was further disturbed by just the local paper when talking about the report in that just came out. Instead of calling them rubber bullets, they were calling them rubber pellets.
It's the sort of thing that you feed to birds in your bird feeder. You know, mm-hmm. You give them little rubber pellets
when you want to play a little joke on them.
Yeah, little CS gas, and you know, just watch them stagger around a little bit.
So you, staying on this on the vein of this subject, you had done an article about the Kaiser Aluminum protest. I guess
demonstrations.
Okay, and there's some incredible tangents to this police report and the WTO stuff, and I was wondering if you could tell us about that.
Yeah, there's been all kinds of interesting things that I've been digging around and digging up this week. One of them is that the Tacoma Police, according to an article in the News Tribune a couple days ago, were using intelligence on the Direct Action Network in Seattle, which there's a question as to whether an outside police agency can do what SPD is not legally allowed to do against a political organization within the city limits of Seattle. One of the reasons that they were so panicked about the Kaiser Aluminum demonstrations is because somebody struck up a conversation with somebody in the Dan office in Seattle, and somebody said, "Oh yeah, it's going to be just like the WTO," and the officer dutifully noted, "It's going to be just like the WTO. They're going to break all kinds of windows downtown," and so we had a problem of a police officer who was a little too credulous in that case. At the same time, we've got all sorts of interesting reports. John Youngdahl, who is the lead organizer for the steelworkers who made the decision to cancel the demonstrations against Kaiser Aluminum, basically lied to the public and to the media, and for that matter to me, when he said that we canceled these demonstrations because we were just too busy with the sit-ins and trying to get legislation passed in Olympia. That was certainly a consideration. However, a much greater consideration, and I've got this from a half dozen witnesses at meetings in Tacoma, at meetings with the Jobs with Justice group in Portland, a greater consideration was that they were scared of anarchists from Eugene coming up and engaging in property destruction during the demonstrations. They were concerned about the hit to their public image that would take if that happened. And apparently, they got the information that anarchists from Eugene, which is the all-purpose, modern-day boogeyman that's being used to scare people around left politics these days, the idea that anarchists were coming up from Eugene came directly from the Tacoma Police Department. We know that the Tacoma Police Department had a couple meetings with the steelworkers at which they discussed this. We don't know of any place else that the steelworkers could have gotten the information. Neither side is really talking, so it's hard to confirm it, but it seems pretty logical that that's where they got the information. So you have a left group, in this case the steelworkers, which is a pretty progressive union, going out on a limb, spending several weeks organizing with community activist groups, and then on the word of the Tacoma Police Department, which in turn came from a phone call from the Eugene Police Department saying, "We've been tracking some of the anarchists in our city, and a couple of them are missing. We can't find them. They don't appear to be in town anymore. So we thought they might have gone up there." Well, this caused Tacoma Police to panic. That appears to be where most of the information came from, is that silly phone call. So very weak information about a threat that is part and parcel of any community activist group. If you're going to invite the public is bound to come up, including anarchists, and you have to trust in them to do what's best for the purposes of the demonstration. It's very, very disturbing that a left group would take the word of the police over the word of its own allies. And it calls into question how unions and community activist groups are going to be able to work together, how this much-heralded new alliance between labor and environment, between labor and religious groups, labor and youth, and so forth, how that's going to happen with the leadership of the unions. It's very much happening with the rank and file. In fact, after I wrote the column with the Weekly, I heard from several people who were part of the 50 or so who went down to Kaiser Aluminum that Saturday, the originally scheduled demonstration that was supposed to have 2,000 people. Well, it had about 300 cops and about 50 demonstrators, and they were being pulled over and harassed and run ragged by the cops. And in the course of of being under fire as they were, they developed something of a bonding and a camaraderie with each other that will carry over into future actions. That's all well and fine for the rank and file and for community activists, but you have to have the leadership of the unions on board, or it's never gonna grow, never gonna reach any kind of critical mass. Because most people, when they hear that a demonstration has not been authorized by the leadership of the union, they're going to stay away, just like they stayed away in Tacoma. It's a very much of a problem that's going to have to be solved if we're going to have this alliance at all in the future.
Hmm. Now, in addition to that, you, I believe, uncovered a particular story that relates to this involving an arrest of an anarchist.
Yeah, well, a supposed arrest. One of the things that was used by the Tacoma police to justify the incredible police presence that they had at the demonstration that had been called off for literally hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of overtime billed to the taxpayers of Tacoma, which they should be utterly outraged about. One of the things they used to justify this was a report that showed up in the News Tribune and then was reprinted on Monday on an AP story that was run in the Post-Intelligencer, saying that the Tacoma police on Saturday had arrested an anarchist from a, quote, known anarchist from the Eugene area, unquote, who had in the back seat two loaded rifles and a loaded shotgun. Well, it turns out that it was a state patrol stop, and the state patrol said this was, quote, a complete non-incident, unquote. There was no arrest. Somebody was pulled over for making an illegal turn. They noticed there were weapons in the back seat, and they reported it to Tacoma. That was the extent of the incident. Now, there is, you know, maybe some people are scared by the idea of having anarchists with guns in the back seat, but there's nothing illegal about being an anarchist, and there's nothing illegal about having guns in the back seat if they're not concealed, which they weren't in this case. And, you know, there was no arrest. End of story. But this was used to really put the fear of God into people and saying, you know, oh my God, the violent anarchists are going to come. They're going to shoot up the plant. They're going to blow up the Port of Tacoma. I mean, literally, this was in the News Tribune a couple of days ago that the police were afraid that the anarchists were going to come and with a well-made home explosive, we're going to hurl an explosive into the Kaiser plant that was going to initiate a chain reaction that was going to blow up the Port of Tacoma. How idiotic. But the problem is that we're seeing the specter of the WTO and seeing the specter of the evil, violent anarchists as being used to justify enormous police presences at almost any demonstration in the Pacific Northwest right now. It's very disturbing because the public has really been spooked by this, and I don't know what can be done to educate the public that, number one, not all anarchists are violent. Number two, the ones that are violent are breaking store windows, which does not compare with the violence initiated by the cops. And number three, they're a very tiny minority compared to the vast majority of nonviolent demonstrators, which, like the anarchists themselves, are a cross section of society that are your neighbors and your friends.
And being very peaceful and doing things, you know, like sitting down.
Yeah, we can't have that. That's why we apply a pepper spray directly to their face, which was, you know, the praises of less than lethal munitions were sung very widely in the SPD After Action report. It was quite disturbing.
Mm. All right. Well, we are just about out of time, and we still have something very important to cover. The War Tax Resistance. There's a conference coming up about that.
Well, not a conference, a workshop.
It's
happening today, 1 to 4 o'clock at University Friends Meeting. If you're interested in how you go about it, it's probably a little too late to be thinking about for this year, but maybe for next year, if you're just outraged by what the federal government is doing with your tax dollars, and you want to find out ways to resist that. It's a little bit scary, but people do it, and people have been doing it for many years, and they survived the IRS just fine, thank you. That's happening from today from 1 to 4 o'clock at the University Friends Meeting House in the University District in Seattle.
Very good. And we've had people on the show before about that, and it sounds like a really actually great program, and like you say, it's not so scary once you get over that first hurdle.
Yep.
There's people there that'll hold your hand.
Oh, yeah.
All right. Well, that's about all the time we've got for you today. We're talking once again with Jov Parrish, co-editor of Eat the State and columnist for the Seattle Weekly, who's just about off to D.C.
I am.
And I'm very envious.
In swank accommodations, I might add.
Oh, you'll have to bring me back some photos.
Yes.
Once again, Jov, people, where do people find Eat the State?
Well, you find it all over town. We had a fine benefit at the Speakeasy last night. It's a community newspaper that's put out by volunteers. You can get it at bookstores and coffee shops and places where you hang out around town. You can also get it on the web at www.eatthestate.org. You can get it through the mail, $16 for 20 issues, $29 for 40 issues, at P.O. Box 85541, Seattle, Washington 98145. And if you have questions, if you have story ideas, if you want to volunteer, help out, we're always anxious and eager to engage the public, as it were. You can give our voicemail a call at area code 206-903-9461.
Very good. So we'll be talking to you by phone next week.
Indeed.